calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
There we go. Push the right button and you get the right microphone. I was wondering. Greetings, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Maria Cohen makes a note to Mark Crispin Miller, which he shared with those of us on his spam list. She says, Guckert, this the latest in the Gannongate story. Jeff Guckert made more than three dozen excursions to the White House when there were no scheduled briefings. According to CNN, Monica Lewinsky visited the White House about three dozen times. However, Monica Lewinsky was officially a government employee, and Jeff Guckert was officially a male prostitute. So what's up with this? What was Gannon doing in the White House when there were no briefings scheduled? What was he doing spending 9 hours in the White House at a time? Was he getting marching orders from the Department of Dirty Tricks? Asks Mark Crispin Miller rhetorically. Or was he there in his professional capacity? Which might it be? The Secret Service has furnished logs of the writer's access to the White House after requests by two Democratic Congress members, Representative Louise Slaughter and Representative John Conyers, through their Freedom of Information Act request, revealed Guckert had remarkable access to the White House, notes John Byrne in a Raw Story article. Was he there in his professional capacity as a shill for George W. Bush, so George, when he got hard questions during the White House press conferences, could always know that he could, let's go to Jeff for the next question? Or was he there in his official capacity as a prostitute? He had little to no previous journalism experience. In this article by John Byrne, Raw Story, March 2003, Guckert left the White House twice on days he'd never checked in with the Secret Service. Over the next 22 months, he failed to check out with the service on 13 days. And several of these visits, Guckert either entered or exited by a different entry exit point than his usual one. On one of these days, no briefing was held. No briefing was held. Actually, it turns out, as they dig a little deeper, three dozen of these meetings, or of these days, no briefing was held. Who was he visiting? What was he doing to them, with them? Or what were they doing to him? Perhaps inquiring minds don't want to know, but this is the same bunch who will never let you forget. The question is not what he was doing in the White House, but who. Yeah, exactly. Zaphod in our chat room. By the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com if you'd like to call into the program anytime, any topic, 1-866-889-8894. We have an open phone lines policy on the Tom Hartman program here. So Jeff Gannon, what was he doing? Now, here's where it gets really interesting. The question, of course, who's inviting a male prostitute into the White House on days when there is none of his other business? That is, there's no press conferences going on, no briefings. Who's inviting him in? Since December 2004, all but one of Gannon's 48 temporary appointments were requested by Lois Cassano, a White House press office media assistant. One additional request was made by Peter Watkins, a press assistant who now works as deputy press secretary to First Lady Laura Bush. As I was saying earlier, this is the same bunch that will never let you forget that Jack Kennedy was getting a little on the side in the White House, that Franklin Roosevelt died in his mistress's arms down in Hot Springs, Arkansas, that doesn't like to talk about the fact that Dwight Eisenhower had a mistress for many, many years, that you know, likes to remark on Bill Clinton's indiscretions. And, of course, the list goes on and on. This is the bunch that has been bringing a male prostitute into the White House for 3.5 years now, and we're not sure why. And they don't want to talk about it. And we're not sure why they don't want to talk about it. I can come up with some fair guesses, I think, on that. Can't you? Why would he come to the White House and be there for several hours when there's no press conference? Inquiring minds want to know. Maybe not all the details, but, you know, what's he doing? Or who's he doing, as Zaphod says. Bill Frist this weekend falls on bended knee to the, quote, American is a Christian nation and do away with the heathen judges crowd, end quote. What an opportunistic anti-constitution craven Tory, notes BuzzFlash.com. Did you see this? Did you see this thing on TV? This was remarkable. Justice Sunday. Justice Sunday, they called this. And then went on to misrepresent the reality of the situation and, to lie about it. It's mind-boggling, some of the things were said. First of all, filibusters. Let's talk about filibusters for a moment. Because obstructionist tactics block so many Clinton administration nominees, notes the National Women's Law Center, the Senate failed to confirm over one-third of the Clinton nominations to the Court of Appeals. Now, what's the difference between the Clinton nominees and the Bush nominees? Why is it that all of a sudden now the full Senate is having to filibuster nominees to the appeals courts, the federal appeals courts, when, by and large, they didn't in the past? They did, of course. There was actually a filibuster vote in the year 2000, the last year of the Clinton administration, by Bill Frist. Yes, Bill Frist used the filibuster. But then there's this question, why was it that during the Clinton administration, if one-third of the people that he tried to send up to the Hill were not confirmed, there were no filibusters, or just very, very few, most notably this one in 2000 led by Bill Frist? Well, the reason why was because the Clinton administration was playing it straight. They were being honest about things. The Clinton administration came in and said, they would go to the leaders of the Senate and they would say, do we have 60 votes for Joe Blow? Here's our nominee, Joe Blow, and just wondering, are we going to have 60 votes for this person? And if the Senate said, Republicans and Democrats, yes, we can pull together 60 votes, then the Clinton administration would send up the nominee. If they didn't have 60 votes, they didn't bother, because it takes 60 votes to break a filibuster. There were many Clinton nominees who were submitted to committees and never made it out. Never made it out. The judicial... No, wait a second here. The Clinton Justice Department official acknowledged that the administration's... acknowledged that administration's reluctance to nominate judges unless over 60 Senate votes for confirmation were expected. That's right. Nearly 170 Bush judicial nominations have now been confirmed. The judicial vacancy rate is at the lowest in 13 years. We are now, as Pat Leahy of Vermont points out, the vacancy rate on the federal judiciary is now lower than the national unemployment rate. There are fewer unemployed federal judges than there are unemployed average people in America. Go figure. Since 1980, cloture motions, the way filibusters are broken, have been filed on 14 Court of Appeals and District Court nominations, according to the Congressional Research Service. That's since 1980. For example, cloture petitions were necessary in 2000 to obtain votes on the nomination of Richard Páez and Marsha Berzin to the Ninth Circuit after opponents repeatedly delayed action on them for over 4 years in Páez's case, and then openly declared a filibuster. Senator Frist was among those voting against cloture on the Páez nomination. But by and large, the way that they shot down Clinton administration nominees was letting them die quiet, invisible deaths in committee. When Senator Hatch chaired the Judiciary Committee from 1995 to 2001, dozens of highly qualified judicial nominees had no hearing at all, or had a hearing but no committee action. These included two nominees to the D.C. Circuit, that would be the First Circuit, Elena Kagan and Ellen Snyder, two Hispanic nominees to the Fifth Circuit, Jorge Rangel and Enrique Moreno, and several female nominees, such as Helen White for the Sixth Circuit, who went over 4 years without a hearing. What the Republicans are complaining about, they did in aces. I mean, they did just far more. See, this is a really significant issue, because if you pass a bad bill, you can always reverse it. If the legislature passes a bad bill, a bad piece of legislation, it can always be backed out of. You can always pass another piece of legislation that essentially reverses it or that undoes it. You can unsign, depending on where it is in the process and things. Things can be shot down. Legislation can always be reversed. Bad laws can always be changed or fixed. But a judicial nomination is for life. Yes, you can impeach a bad judge, but it is so rare that it's essentially not an issue. It is so rare. For all practical purposes, just doesn't happen. There are 40 vacancies right now in the federal courts. When Bill Clinton left, there were 111 vacancies. You see, what happened was during the last 3-4 years of the Clinton administration, the Republicans, hoping that they could take power in 2000, started obstructing Clinton's nominees, so that when they came into office, there was this huge opening of federal judges. They all kinds of, you know, help wanted signs out so they could get all kinds of good right-wing judges in there, which they have been doing, other than the toxic 10. So the question that I think America needs to ask, and that isn't being asked, is why would a multi-multi-millionaire senator who consistently votes to harm the hungry and the poor, who so concerned Jesus, join forces with religious fundamentalists to stack this nation's highest courts? Could it be because he and his wealthy Republican friends see huge financial benefits for themselves and for their corporate patrons in a compliant court? So this is really what it's all about. I am convinced. I am absolutely and utterly convinced. This is really what it's all about. Is that Bill Frist showed up for this Justice Sunday thing, and he is pushing so hard for these nominees because they know that if they can get these guys into office, on Monday they will ban abortion. On Tuesday they will ban the minimum wage. Keep in mind, the Supreme Court of the United States has in the past ruled that the minimum wage is unconstitutional. It has in the past ruled that overtime laws are unconstitutional. It has in the past ruled that people have no right to unionization, to democracy in the workplace. The Supreme Court has in the past ruled, well, the list goes on and on. I mean, most of these were in the teens and 20s, just of the last century, in the 1900, 1910, 1920 era. And of course, it all changed when Roosevelt came in, essentially, you know, filling up the court, as it were. But this is what it's about.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I heard a minister the other day talking about the great injustice and evil of the men in white robes, the Ku Klux Klan that roamed the country in the South. And they did great wrong to civil rights and to morality. And now we have black-robed men, and that's what you're talking about.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them.
Yes, there, James Dobson.
Gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus-pocus. You misdirected them.
Yes.
With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein.
That works so well.
You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. It is 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. He seems to be going out of his way to pander to the radical religious right leaders, says Ralph Neese, president of the People for the American Way, speaking of Bill Frist. Now, why would Bill Frist be doing this? He's not running for re-election. He's leaving the Senate in a year and a half. He has announced this. So why would he be going out on this? Could it be that it reflects his real, true beliefs? That now that he's not up for re-election, he really and truly can say, okay, he's, you know, that he's really not in favor of democracy, that he'd really like to see a theocracy in the United States. Could it be that now that he's not up for re-election, he's free to pursue his true interests, his hundreds of millions of dollars? And he wants to be sure that he has a Supreme Court in place that will look out for the interests of wealthy dynastic families. I mean, this is a guy whose family business, private hospitals, made possible by the fact that states, starting during the Reagan Revolution, began saying, okay, you no longer have to have a nonprofit corporation to run a hospital. For-profit corporations can now run hospitals. And so Bill Frist's family jumped into this business, and they made hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, their company, this is after they sold it, but their company has been hit with one of the largest fines ever for defrauding Medicare. Over $1 billion. Two fines in aggregate, over $1.6 billion. The largest single fine, over $800 million. $800 million in a fine. And they could pay it out of their pocket change. Can you imagine? $800 million. And this is the guy who wants to be president in 2008? Is that what this is about? That Bill Frist wants to run for president? Or could it be that he wants to retire comfortably and make sure that his class, the investor class, as they're referred to by Business Week, that the investor class is comfortable in their oligarchy? I'm telling you, the real fascists are coming out of the woodwork now. The true fascists, the true oligarchs, those who do not believe in democracy, those who instead want to see a nation ruled by the wealthy few and by the corporate interests that represent them or that they represent. Pure and simple. And this has a long history, a long tradition. In American politics, as well as world politics, when this country was founded, you had Alexander Hamilton running around saying, and John Adams saying, we have to look out for the wealthy because they're the ones who will create a stable ruling class in the United States. We can't let the rabble run things. You can't let the rabble directly elect the Senate. The Senate has to be there to represent the wealthy, just like the House of Lords versus the House of Commons in the UK. That was the original idea. It wasn't until 1917 that you and I, the rabble, actually got to vote on who our senators would be. And so here they come again. And the way that they want to do it is by seizing control of the courts, and they're using the religious right to do their bidding. These poor, poor misguided folks. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. How do I know that what Bill Frist is really all about is protecting the interests of the mega wealthy in America rather than looking out for the interests of those who want to make abortion illegal? Because that's the very narrow agenda of the Dobsons of the world. They are, and the Donahues and whatnot, they're very much about, let's go back to having abortion be illegal in the United States. If you watched this Justice Sunday thing on Sunday, yesterday, you got it. I mean, that is their agenda. Period. And they're claiming that these toxic 10, that these nominees that the Bush administration has put forth are people of faith? Well, it turns out one of them actually is, by their definition anyway. That would be Pryor, this guy who has said that, you know, he would vote to outlaw abortion. But many of them have never discussed abortion, and many of them have never discussed religion. For example, Priscilla Owen. Priscilla Owen has voted against consumers and workers and in favor of businesses over and over and over again. She's all about corporate oligarchy. In a series of rulings, Justice Owen wrote, or joined opinions that severely limited the ability of workers to recover for on-the-job injuries. These cases included the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission versus Garcia and Lawrence versus CDB Services, where she upheld the right of employers to seek from their employees in exchange for certain medical and death benefits waivers of their right to sue for workplace injuries. You get injured in the workplace, you come to your employer, you say, I'm going to the doctor. Will you pay for it? They say, yes, we'll pay for the doctor bill if you promise not to sue us. Then you get to the doctor and discover that you're going to be 6 months in the hospital. No, you can't sue. Sorry, you just signed a waiver. She dissented in interpreting statutory law in a way that would have broadly protected manufacturers from liability for injuries caused by equipment they manufactured. And this is what she's about. Pryor, William Pryor, the Alabama Attorney General, has sought to limit federal legislation to protect civil and constitutional rights. He's a good guy. Janice Rogers Brown argued that the First Amendment protects the use of racial slurs in the workplace, even when they rise to the level of illegal racial discrimination. She said that affirmative action is at odds with federal law. But most important, in Lauder versus the City of Glendale, antagonism toward the right of workers. Brown would have imposed a bright-line rule allowing drug tests for all employees. This option raises very serious concerns about Brown's commitment to upholding settled law in both the workers' rights context and many other areas of civil rights and liberties. Brett Kavanaugh. His qualification for the job? He was responsible, when he worked for Ken Starr, for drafting the office's articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton. That's what this guy did to get himself on the roadmap. 1-866-889-8894, the telephone number. Jack in Louisiana on the line. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. All right. I'm in Louisiana, but I'm actually a Tennessee native and a Christian and a Democrat. And I've been following Swift for quite a while now, and you mentioned earlier about his troubles with the HCA, his family hospital company's troubles with the government.
Right.
His father and his brother are still the main shareholders in that company, even when they were paying that $1 billion fine to the government. They're still actively involved in that corporation.
Ah, well, thank you for that. I knew that he was not, but I didn't know to what extent the rest of his family was or wasn't.
He's not, but his family definitely is. The father in particular lives in a house that would make Rockefeller blanch. It's so big and ostentatious in the middle of on the edge of Nashville, along a huge park. But at any rate, what I want to know as a Democrat and a Christian, and I consider myself a Tennessean even though I don't live there anymore, is when is the Democratic Party in the state of Tennessee going to stand up for me? When are they going to say, when is Governor Bredesen or Jim Sasser or somebody going to say that it's okay to be a Democrat and a Christian in the state of Tennessee and Bill Frist is wrong about that?
Yeah, well, why do you think that the Democratic Party is saying that it's not okay to be a Democrat and a Christian?
Because they're not responding to his ridiculous comments over the weekend.
His charges and attacks and things, yeah.
Exactly. Where's the protest? Where's the outrage that he would appear at this on this teleconference with these evangelicals out of Louisville? It's ridiculous that he can
get
out there and say that without anybody responding.
Yeah, everybody in politics is very reluctant to grab hold of religion because they feel that they can get burned by it. And you know, I think that that's a mistake, frankly. I think that the Democratic Party needs to be right up front, that they are religion-friendly. The Democratic Party is really and truly the party that is religion-friendly. They say,
absolutely,
whatever your religion, that's great. We're not going to meddle in it. We're not going to mess with it. We're not going to restrict it. We're not going to inhibit it. We're not going to prohibit it. And we're not going to promote it. Whatever your religion is, that's your religion. Whereas the Republicans... Well, let me just finish this. Whereas the Republicans say, oh, you have a religion? How can we exploit that? Oh, it's Muslim? We'll put you in prison. Oh, it's a fundamentalist right-wing Christian? Oh, we'll give you $1 billion. The black churches this last year, part of that billion went to black churches and doubled the amount of the support for George W. Bush at the polls from coming out of black churches as a consequence of the faith-based initiative program. The Republicans look to exploit religion. The Democrats look to honor religion. It's just that simple.
Howard Dean ran for president with the phrase, it's time for the Democratic Party to take back the American flag. Well, I think now it's time for the Democratic Party to take back the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you. Thanks a lot for making a good point, Jack. Yeah, you too. Keep up the great work. 1-866-889-8894. Tina in Indiana is on the line. Hey, Tina, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just have a question. The more I hear of all this stuff going on, the more angry I get. And I'm just wondering if you think at some point that Americans are just going to have a civil uprising and revolt. I mean, all of the attacks that have been perpetrated on the American people by this administration since they've been in office, how long do you think it's going to be before these people, ordinary, everyday citizens who are getting everything stripped away from them, the rights for their jobs, minimum wage and overtime and just all of the things that they're doing to us, how long is it going to be before the common ordinary man starts assassinating rich people? Because, they're flaunting it in our faces.
Yeah, the assassinating rich people part, I don't see happening. But what I do see happening is the same thing that happened back in the 30s, and that is the American people looking around and going, okay, the GOP is the party of the industrialists and the robber barons, basically, and inherited wealth. They're the party of inherited wealth and corporate power. And they've brought along for the ride the Christian conservatives who don't realize that they're being exploited by the GOP or are perfectly willing to be exploited in exchange for the power that they get. They're willing to make that deal. They're willing to take the 30 pieces of silver in exchange for the juice, you know. And Americans are waking up to this, and I think that in the 2006 and 2008 elections, Republicans are in for a huge surprise. They're assuming that we can get these voting machines cleaned up.
Right. Well, that was another question, actually, relating to the voting machines. If it is proven at some point that those were rigged and that the elections in 2000 and 2004 were stolen, wouldn't that make Bush's presidency an illegitimate presidency, which would then make it possible to reverse all of these judge appointments and all of these other wicked things that they've done since he's been in office?
Unfortunately, no. First of all, Bush's presidency, his 2000 presidency, was illegitimate. He was not elected by the United States. He was not elected by the Electoral College. He wasn't elected by we the people. And we learned that a year after the fact when the New York Times and the Washington Post in November, on November 11th, no, November 12th or 13th of 2001, was it 2001? Perhaps, yeah, of 2001, published the summaries where they went through and actually counted all the ballots in Florida, and they found that had the recount only been done in the four counties around the Miami area, that Al Gore would have lost and Bush would have won. But if you counted the entire state, the measure you use to count, if you pregnant chads, unpregnant, hanging chads, falling chads, dimpled chads, whatever, the intent of the voter, not the intent of the voter, whatever measure you used, Gore beat Bush. And Al Gore knows it. They buried it in the 16th paragraph of the article in the New York Times. The first 15 paragraphs talking about how if Al Gore had pursued his strategy, his initial lawsuit strategy of only having those first four counties, counties recounted, he would have lost. And then in the 16th paragraph, they say, but had he continued with the strategy, the make every vote count strategy that was, you know, after the second or third day they got into this thing, well, let's count the whole state, he would have won. He would have won.
Well, knowing that, it actually makes it worse, because even when it's proved that they stole the election, it still doesn't give us a leg to stand on to make it right. I don't know how we can win.
Well, that's the problem, is they have the corporate press in their pocket. I mean, they are the corporate press. You've got, you know, for example, GE owns MSNBC and NBC, and GE is a huge defense contractor. They're making out, they've got to be just loving this war. And the chairman of GE says, you know, when I think the future, I think China, China, China. It's between outsourcing and the war and just all of this stuff. I mean, it's like this very slimy, destructive I'm trying to do everything I can to not use the word conspiracy because, but I don't have, I'm lacking a better word for it. But it's not being done in secret. That's the thing. It's all out there. It's just that it's not being publicized to the average person. Our news is no longer news. It's infotainment. And so the only way the average person is learning about this is either by reading the internet, reading, you know, the progressive websites, reading publications like The Nation or In These Times, the magazines that, that discuss these things, listening to progressive talk radio, and there's very little of it out there. There's only a few stations and a few, you know, basically one network and a few independents. And beyond that, and you've got, you know, a few Democrats who are willing to speak the truth, but they don't get covered all that much. So
right.
It, we have a lot of work and a big job to do, Tina. Tina, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. I do appreciate your calling in, though. Thank you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tom in Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just, you had your caller that called in saying that the Democratic Party has to honor Christians and take back the Bible, and I wanted to a little bit disagree with that take. I think we should make it clear that the Democrats are the party that supports the U.S. Constitution and therefore honors religion by separating church and state to keep religion.
That was my point. The Democrats say you've got a religion, great.
Right. But we're like Bill Maher says, we should be the party of the Constitution and let them be the party of the Bible because they forget about the Constitution.
The
right?
Godless Constitution, they say. The word God does not appear in the Constitution.
Exactly. And he had a good analogy of this. He says, the President of the United States puts his hand on the Bible and swears to uphold the Constitution, not vice versa. You know, he doesn't put his hand on the Constitution to uphold the Bible. I mean, that's what we got to see. We stake our position and say we uphold the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, yeah.
Not get involved in this take back the Bible and in this religious war. That's not the way to go.
No, you know, you're right. You make a good point, Tom. Tom, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. This is, you know, Tom's right. Although I think it's important to say, in the language that the average person can get. Sometimes you have to hijack your opponent's language, you know, to say that it is safe in America to be a Christian or to be any religion and truly into it and be a Democrat. And I think the Democratic Party has traditionally taken that position. I mean, So Judge Boyle, here's another one, Terrence Boyle, another one of these recycled judicial nominees, a protege of former Senator Jesse Helms. Boyle has decided between 11 and 12,000 district court cases. However, only 400 of his opinions have been published. And the administration refuses to make the balance of these opinions public, as they have for previous nominees. Why? What are they hiding with Terrence Boyle? He's been nominated to the Fourth Circuit. He has assailed the Americans with Disabilities Act and has a troubling history of denying voting rights. Could it be that he's the guy who's going to make the machines permanent? The Fourth Circuit, the very court to which Terrence Boyle has been nominated, right, saveyourcourts.org, the very court to which Terrence Boyle has been nominated has repeatedly reversed Boyle's decisions because of plain error and other fundamental legal mistakes. Judge Boyle's rulings have been reversed more than 150 times, an astonishingly high rate of reversal. It raises serious questions about Boyle's fitness to serve at the appellate level. This is just one step below the Supreme Court. Thomas Griffin, the National Women's Law Center, says this guy is currently general counsel at Brigham Young University and has a record of hostility to Title IX. This is the Education Amendments of 1972, the landmark federal law that prohibits sex discrimination in every sphere of education. In addition, Griffith practiced law without a license for several years, first in the District of Columbia and then in Utah. NWLC co-president Marsha D. Greenberger says, and I quote, "Along with Mr. Griffith's dismissive attitude toward court decisions with which he agrees, his practice of law without a license reflects a disrespect for the rule of law." William Haynes, another one of these recycled judges. Senator Edward Kennedy says, and I quote, "His answers to written questions have been evasive, and he has resisted repeated requests for clarification of his position on several important issues." What is his current job? He's the head lawyer for, just think for a minute, who would be the worst person Donnie Rumsfeld. Sure enough, he's the general counsel to the Department of Defense. The refusal to treat any of the hundreds of persons detained at Guantanamo as prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions, notes Ted Kennedy, the Defense Department's military tribunal plan, which has been condemned by human rights organizations and our closest allies, the indefinite detention of U.S. citizens without counsel or judicial review, it's his work. And this is a guy that the Bush administration wants to put into the circuit courts where they will be one step away from the Supreme Court, William Haynes. The Republicans and their nuclear option. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Now you love me as a loser, but now you're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline.
It's Leonard Cohen. No particular political message there, just Leonard Cohen, one of the great poets of our time. Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We have a Bolton alert for you. We have a Bush Social Security alert for you. Coming from two different directions, we're going to get back into what's going on with Tom DeLay. Oh, boy, is this getting weird. Day 8 of the Political Death Watch in Doonesbury. You know things are strange politically when talk show hosts are quoting cartoonists. And it's real. It's about what's really going on. In any case, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Alice in Humboldt County is on the line with us. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Alice.
In one of your programs a couple of weeks ago, we learned that Bush was told first that exit polls were coming in, and that he was losing big.
That he had already lost, in fact, yes.
Yeah. He did not care, he said.
That's
the
right.
The exit polls meant nothing.
That's what he told Karen Hughes.
How do you think he knew that?
I am... Well, I have to say, Alice, I think he knew that because he knew that his people on the ground would do whatever it takes. And in some cases, whatever it takes is, in my opinion, rigging voting machines. In other cases, whatever it takes is making sure that people who are most likely to vote Democratic can't get to a voting machine or can't get to a poll, and on and on. You know, I just think that he knew that his people were not going to let him, they were going to come through, that they weren't going to blow it.
No.
And they did.
No.
But I don't believe that he was elected. I really don't. I don't either. I believe the exit polls were right, and I believe that more than half of Americans did not vote for him but voted against him, and that's why he's been so low in the public opinion polls ever since the election. It's because he wasn't actually voted in by the majority of the people. The exit polls were right. John Kerry won by about 3%, in my opinion. And there's an enormous body of good science to back this up. So, Alice, thanks for the call, and thanks for raising that issue. That'll stir them up on the right there.
Oh, yeah, we need a little stir up.
There you go. Keep up the great work, Alice.
Yeah,
great
okay.
to hear from you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Now, first we get the voting machines back and make the software open source or get rid of them all together. Why do we have corporations involved in our voting to begin with? Can you come up with any reason other than making money and rigging votes?
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And another Bolton victim has stepped forward. The Bolton Gate saga continues to unfold. They named it everything Gate for Clinton. Why not do it for Bush, right? This is quite a remarkable one. Lynn D. Finney, who alleges that Bolton mistreated her when they worked in the General Counsel's office at the U.S. Agency for International Development. Now get this, the USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, oversees much of the money that the federal government uses for helping victims of famine, victims of disasters, but mostly development stuff. It's really poor areas, going into really poor areas and saying, okay, we're going to help bring these people out of poverty. We're going to help bring them into the 20th century we're living, that sort of thing. That's what USAID does. And the reason why we've done it all these years is that it's good PR, basically. I mean, you know, in a very, not altogether terribly cynical, but just straightforward way. It's good PR for the country, and that's good for us. If we can cause people around the world to think well of the United States because we helped them stop a malaria epidemic or we helped them raise healthy children or whatever, then, you know, that's a net positive. There's something good about that. It means that the people in that country are not going to grow up to hijack airplanes and fly them into buildings in New York City. So AID is going along, and here's this woman. She's working with AID, and Bolton was the lawyer, or a lawyer. He worked in the general counsel's office for USAID. This guy's had a lot of jobs in his career. He's a lawyer in the general counsel's office at USAID, and in the early 1980s, he asked her, this Lindy Finney, he goes to this woman, and he says that she should help him, or that she should simply do it herself, actually, persuade delegates from other countries to vote with the United States to weaken World Health Organization restrictions on marketing of infant formula in the developing world. Now, there's a reason why they're not out there hustling, that we don't want to be supporting the hustling of infant formula in the developing world. And that is because, you know, it's fine in the developed world, although actually the latest research shows that it's not fine anywhere under any circumstances in many cases. I mean, you know, you got a mother who can't produce milk or you have absolutely no other options, fine. It serves a useful and important purpose. But to replace mother's milk? No. Then you're cutting back on the ability of children to have, you know, decent, strong, healthy immune systems, and there's all, you know, all sorts of things here. But in the developing world, it's even more of a problem because very often this stuff gets thinned out with water in order to stretch it so that it'll last longer because these people can't afford very much of it. Or, even worse, it gets mixed with contaminated water and you end up with children who, you know, at the age of 3 months or 6 months have diarrheal diseases that cause them not to absorb any nutrients at all and to die in many cases. And no, I'm not exaggerating. There are many, I mean, we're talking large, I don't know if it's millions or if it's hundreds of thousands, frankly. It's been probably 20 years since I really seriously looked at the numbers and all the research. I mean, there have been books written about this. But how many children have died as a result of infant formula? How many children have died as a result of the misuse of infant formula, the inappropriate mixing of it? But it's substantial. So anyhow, Bolton goes to Finney, and he asks her, he says, the U.S., this is in the Reagan administration, he says, the U.S. wants to weaken the controls on the marketing of infant formula that the World Health Organization has put in place. The World Health Organization is saying, basically, to companies like Nestle, you can't market infant formula in the third world aggressively without certain disclaimers. You can't do it at all in particular areas where there's not uncontaminated water. You know, things like this. There are these very specific, limitations on the behavior of the infant formula corporations that are put into place by the World Health Organization. And it's a good thing that they're there. It is saving lives. So Bolton comes to her and says, we want to do away with these restrictions. And she says, no. She says that she told Bolton improper use of formula can be deadly, and therefore she would not go along with his plan to loosen the controls on the marketing of formula in third world countries. And according to Finney, quote, Now, this is her. These are her words, not mine. According to Finney, Bolton, quote, shouted that Nestle was an important company and that he was giving me a direct order from President Reagan. He yelled that if I didn't obey him, he would fire me. I said I could not live with myself if even one baby died because of something I did, and he screamed that I was fired. Fired. So, is this the guy that we want representing us at the United Nations? A guy who thinks that Nestle's interests are more important than America's interests? A guy who thinks that Nestle's interests are more important than the interests of living human beings? What happened to the right to life? What happened to family values? What happened to looking out for children? Oh, excuse me. I forgot. They're only interested before birth. And now we discover, to further boggle the mind, John Bolton's involvement in the Libya situation. Now, the Republicans are out there trying to say, and they're doing this in all the talk shows, oh, the only problem with Bolton is that he's blunt and abrasive, and actually, that might be a good thing to have in the UN, because we need to whip these guys into shape. That's their talking point. I mean, I'm getting them with all the conservative talking points and the emails in the morning, you know, it's this is what we're going to hammer on today. Bolton is just, you know, he's just a tough guy, but that's what we need at the United Nations. And whenever topics come up about him conflating intelligence or him lying to his boss, Colin Powell, or him, you know, helping the Bush administration cobble together a phony reason to go to war in Iraq, change the subject to, well, he's a tough guy and you might not like his personality, but we need a tough guy at the UN. Those are the talking points that have been coming out for the last 4 or 5 days now, the last week or more, actually. And Sean Hannity's right on point. All these guys, they're right on point. They're repeating the Republican talking points so well. And obviously, you can see Frank Luntz's hand in this. They have obviously focus grouped this. They've obviously tested the words. But that's really not what it's about. That's really not what it's about. What it's about is that this guy is incompetent. He is incompetent. And incompetence in diplomacy is dangerous. This guy is a threat to the United States of America. He is a threat to you and me. He is a threat to our children. He is a threat to the hope, the aspiration that all Americans hold of living in a world at peace. Well, most Americans. I realize there are a few defense contractors out there and the Bush family who rather like worlds at war. It helps them get reelected. It helps increase their power. It helps increase their wealth. But by and large, most Americans would really rather live in a world at peace. Thank you very much. So, you know, the one success that the Bush administration has claimed, and again, the con talking points, they'll never let you forget this. The one success that they have claimed is that Muammar Gaddafi had sort of a little bit of a kind of thinking about maybe nuclear weapons program. And Muammar Gaddafi is sitting on an enormous amount of oil that the American oil companies wanted to get to. It's profitable, and it will help solve the energy problem here in America if we can start importing Libyan oil. So the oil companies go to George W. Bush. George W. Bush goes to the State Department and says, I don't care what it takes, work out something with Libya. We've got to achieve a rapprochement. This guy has admitted to being a terrorist, admitted to blowing up Pan Am Flight 103, paid compensation to the families, admitted to blowing up this nightclub in Germany. He is a terrorist, but he says he's changed his ways, so we'll give him that. We wouldn't give Carla Faye Tucker that, but we'll give it to Muammar Gaddafi. Carla Faye Tucker wasn't sitting on billions of barrels of oil, after all. Carla Faye Tucker, of course, the woman in Texas who had become a born-again Christian and who begged in person begged George Bush to spare her life, and nonetheless, he sent her to the gas chamber, or the whatever it was, the lethal injection chamber. So the one victory that the Bushies have been claiming, and they've been running around saying, hey, we look at this, we got Libya. We got Libya. Isn't this great? Gaddafi has given up his nuclear program. His nuclear program consisting of, you know, a shoebox and a lab in some university in Tripoli or something. And it was a joke. But yeah, Gaddafi's giving it up, and he's going to give up his terrorist ways and he's going to sell us oil. And he's giving up his terrorist ways, and he's going to sell us oil. And he's no longer going to be blowing up airplanes, and he's going to sell us oil. And he's no longer going to be blowing up nightclubs and supporting terrorism, and he's going to sell us oil. And so isn't it wonderful? This is the great diplomatic. And see, this proves that the war in Iraq was a good thing, because Gaddafi did this because of the war in Iraq, and he wants to sell us oil. So now we discover that John Bolton, who screwed up the Iran negotiations, screwed up the Korea negotiations, nuclear negotiations, trying to stop them from becoming nuclear states. He is, after all, the Undersecretary for Arms Control and Nuclear Proliferation. Screwed it up totally. This now comes from thinkprogress.org. There are serious, well-publicized concerns about John Bolton's treatment of subordinates. His defenders argue that Bolton's blunt style is what makes him an effective diplomat. In fact, Bolton's record is riddled with serious diplomatic failures. This from this morning's Newsweek. And I quote Newsweek. On several occasions, America's closest ally in the war on terror, Britain, was irked by what U.S. and British sources say were efforts by Bolton to undermine promising diplomatic openings. Perhaps the most dramatic instance took place early in the U.S.-British talks in 2003 to force Libya to surrender its nuclear program, Newsweek has learned. The Libya deal succeeded only after British officials at the highest level, a euphemism for Tony Blair, persuaded the White House to keep Bolton off the negotiating team. The White House agreed to keep Bolton out of the loop, as one source puts it. Out of the loop. And this is the guy that we want to send to the United Nations. Wait till you hear about John Bolton and Jack Straw, but first, a Bush Social Security alert right after this. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 25 minutes past the hour. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is with us. Ellen, you just got back from Iraq.
I certainly did, and I tried to actually call you from over there, but we had just so many problems with the sat phones, and you had to be outside, and then other times we were in helicopters. It was quite an experience.
I can imagine. Tell us, what is the state of affairs there?
I think there's good news and bad news. Clearly, they are making some attempts at a fledgling democracy. I actually went to a city council meeting, which is actually a district council meeting. There's, I think, 12 districts or something like that in Baghdad. And, you know, it was interesting. They were talking about things like sewer pipe and contracts and things that city councils discuss. On the other hand, when I was there 2 years ago, it was very clear that the biggest problem that they had was electricity generation. 2 years later, their biggest problem is electricity generation, with not a big improvement in how much electricity the Iraqis get. if you want to influence somebody's hearts and minds, then how do you, you know, if you haven't made electricity a priority? The good news is that after 2 years, the military is finally getting it, that they need to do some electricity generation.
Hmm.
But where have they been for 2 years?
Yeah, well.
The other problem is, Tom.
They have a slow learning curve, you know. They're over in the Department of Defense right now.
To say the least. And the other thing is that we are going to be there a very, very long period of time.
Well, that's why we're building 14 permanent bases that are going to be the largest military bases that we have in the world.
Tom, you have no idea how large and how much equipment. These bases are small cities. I've been on military bases in my life, and I've certainly in foreign military bases have never, I'm sure in Germany they're like this, but we've been there for 60 years. They are huge, and the amount of equipment is huge, and the number of contractors over there are huge.
Yeah.
Like nothing I have ever seen.
Well, it's one way to goose the economy, I suppose.
Well,
let's build some tanks.
You mean not goosing our economy, not the Iraqi economy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, because we're making stuff here and shipping it over there.
Well, because the Sri Lankans are the people that are serving people in the chow lines. It's not the Iraqi people. Now, they say that this is a safety issue. Perhaps it is, but, I mean, can you imagine that feels to people like it you know, in
importing cheap
Iraqi
labor.
Right,
the Iraqis
exactly
are saying they're importing cheap labor. It's the Iraqis are feeling under the Bush administration rule in Iraq the same way the middle class in America feels under Bush administration rule here in the United States.
Right. I mean, and I believe if you really want to win their hearts and minds, you also need more than that $18 billion in reconstruction money. You have got to do something that you can possibly do in terms of trying to get real, you know, money into the pockets of the Iraqis.
Yeah.
The other thing is, of course, the insurgency, quote unquote, and where that's coming from. And I heard reports from some Iraqis that they're very worried that the South now is being controlled by Iranian security forces, Iranian intelligence forces. Well, we don't know if that has come to bear yet, but if it has, that will be very difficult in the long run to maintain the kind of peace that's needed for Iraq to continue.
Well, I think there's a pretty broad consensus that the Shia and the Iranians are in bed with each other.
Right. They're in bed, but the question is how many of their forces are really in Iraq, and what problem will that be to American forces in the long run?
Right.
And
what's your take on it?
Well, it's hard to know because nobody has the answers about what they're doing. We also know that the Syrians are up at that water dam, which is a main source of water along the Syrian border up past Ramadi, and that's also a problem where they're having a lot of difficulty.
Hmm.
So there's some real hot spots. I mean, I could go on for hours, but
yeah.
I can give you another update tomorrow on some of this.
Okay, great, because we're just out of time here for this segment. But thanks so much, Ellen Radner. Quite an adventure, it sounds like, you had over there.
It was. I wish you'd go on the next trip.
Yeah. I don't think so. I've spent enough time in war zones and third world countries. I've paid my dues.
I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Ellen, thanks a lot. We'll see you tomorrow. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember.
Oh, this is so good.
When you
listen,
know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
Where their business interests run. You tell them, Jackson Brown, that this is the bottom line. I wrote a piece today for CommonDreams.org. Talking about why would Bill Frist get into bed with right-wing conservative Republicans fundamentalists, he is a Republican. Why would the Republicans, the power elite, why would the robber barons be getting into bed with the church going? Well, to use them. But they're using each other. We give you power, you give us votes. We give you money, you give us votes. You help us stack the court so you can get abortion banned. We'll help you stack the court so that we can get protections for workers banned. It's very simple. Very simple equation. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeff in Phoenix is on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Got a question for you. Tom DeLay started out as an exterminator, correct?
Yeah. Well, more or less. His family is in the oil business, but he had his own business as an exterminator, yeah.
Okay. Now, before he ran for the state or for the Texas House, was that right? He was an exterminator and he went bankrupt. Is that correct?
You know, I don't know at that level of detail, I don't know his history. My understanding is that he was an exterminator, that he was having financial problems with his business, whether he went bankrupt or not, fully, I don't know. You know, they actually filed the papers. And that he blamed the problem of his business on excessive government regulation and used that as the lever for his advertising campaign when he ran for office, that he had seen the consequences of government regulation, excessive government regulation, right up front and personal. It had harmed his small business, and he was going to go to Washington to defend the small businesses of Texas.
Well, I've heard that, but what I'm curious about is I had also heard that he had declared bankruptcy. And what my question is, I mean, the guy's a millionaire today.
Yeah, multi.
A multimillionaire in the space of 20 years on a government salary?
Yeah, the same thing with Richard Nixon.
I didn't become a millionaire.
Same thing with Richard Nixon. A lot of people have wondered that, and it wasn't until after he died that it came out that, you know, a whole bunch of different people were handing Nixon $500,000 at a whack in cash. But yeah, it's a valid question. How did he get to be a millionaire? Well, maybe he had some investment help.
Well, I know they used, well, there was an article in the, the big ugly daily newspaper.
Are you talking about USA Today?
USA Today, that's the one.
Okay.
The one with the pictures.
Yeah.
Anyway, USA Today, there was an article in there that said the ethics rules do not actually apply to investments. Congressmen and senators do their portfolios perform better. They are not prevented from investing in stocks that they are legislating on.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that, frankly. That's a question that we could put to Bernie on Friday. He would know and he would tell us, I'm sure.
Yeah, and also 73%, according to that same article, 73% of congressmen and senators have relatives who are lobbyists.
Yeah.
73%.
Yeah, that's not surprising. I mean, nepotism has a long history in American politics. And actually, sometimes you can make an argument for nepotism, that people who, you know, work with you and who know you really do well. I mean, here Louise works with me on this program, and she knows how I think. That, mm-hmm. I find that useful. Is that nepotism? Well, you know, I suppose so. But I'm not a public servant. I'm a talk show host and an author, that's a little different thing.
Yeah. Can I ask you one more question, too?
Sure.
Honorariums.
Yes.
Was that where politicians got paid to speak at events?
That's right. Right after he left office, George Bush, for example, gave a speech for Reverend Moon and received some mind-boggling amount of money. I don't frankly remember how much now. It was a little less than $1 million, as I recall.
But congressmen and senators are prevented from that now, aren't they?
Again, I'm not sure.
Wasn't there a Reform Act a few
years ago? It's gone forward, it's gone backwards, it's gone forward, it's gone backwards, and I don't know the current state of the law with regard to exactly what members of Congress can and cannot do at that level of detail. I'm sorry.
What about if congressmen or politicians write garbage books that they get paid megabucks for by vagary and stuff like that?
Well, that, you know, Jim Wright, when he was the Democratic Speaker of the House, had to resign over that. But it doesn't seem like that's been a problem for George W. Bush writing his biography and Laura writing hers. His mother, at least, waited until her husband was out of office. But I don't, know all the details of what is and isn't permissible. But as I said, I'm sure Bernie Sanders would know, and he'll be on Friday, so you can call him and ask him.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, great.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. It is day 8. Day 8, says Doonesbury, of the Tom DeLay Political Death Watch. When a disgraced public figure like Newt Gingrich, this from Gary Trudeau, tells you it's time to come clean, it probably is, such as the mounting pressure on the Hammer as he rides out day 8 of his political death watch and his longtime friends at the highest level continue to distance themselves. Then we flash to the White House press room where Roland Headley, the designated toady, he's working for the Department of Toady Affairs, you'll recall, and he's replaced Jeff Gannon. He says, Scott, the president barely knows Tom DeLay, right? Right again, Roland, says Scott. Oh, my. But it is getting a little hot for Mr. DeLay. Turns out this, an article over the weekend in the Washington Post by R. Jeffrey Smith, Washington Post staff writer. The airfare to London and Scotland in 2000 for then House Majority Whip Tom DeLay was charged to an American Express card issued to Jack Abramoff, a Washington lobbyist at the center of federal criminal and tax probe. DeLay has said, on the record, that he had no way of knowing that any lobbyist might have financially supported the trip, either directly or through reimbursements to the nonprofit organization. That from this Washington Post piece, other than the for the record part, which I inserted. Abramoff, again quoting this article by R. Jeffrey Smith, the article also reported that Abramoff submitted an expense voucher to Preston Gates seeking a reimbursement of $12,789.73 to cover expenses for meals, hotels, and transportation during the London and Scotland trip incurred by DeLay, his wife Christine, and two aides. This makes clear the total expenses for all the participants, because DeLay had brought along his entourage, were at least $50,000 more than previously known. DeLay and his wife alone, an average of $2,800 a day. The total costs that are now known, over $120,000. He brought along his right-hand person, one of the members of his staff, Susan Hirschman. She's now a lobbyist, of course. Hirschman and her husband ultimately accumulated charges of 2,073 British pounds, about $3,109 at the prevailing exchange rate for 4 nights in their superior room at the London Four Seasons Hotel. These charges included $129 at the hotel lounge, $75 from the room bar, those little mini bottles, really bolting them down. No pun intended on our UN ambassador nominee. $34 from the gift shop, $422 for chauffeured cars, according to a copy of their hotel bill. The delays ran up $145 in charges for room service, $13 for a valet pressing, $302 for a private car from Heathrow Airport. Go figure. So is this going to stick? What's it going to do? What impact is this going to have on Tom DeLay? Time will tell. Day 8 of the Tom DeLay Political Death Watch. Back to John Bolton just for a moment. One last. The hits keep coming, friends. Colin Powell. This is from Newsweek. This is the Newsweek article. Colin Powell plainly didn't like what he was hearing. At a meeting in London in November 2003, his counterpart, British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, was complaining to Powell about John Bolton. So here you have the Secretary of State, or the equivalent. It's called Foreign Secretary in the UK. You have the British Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, coming to Colin Powell and saying, I have a problem with John Bolton. He is screwing up our attempts to negotiate a nuclear freeze with Iran. Iran and North Korea were both in a box. Under the Clinton administration, they worked out deals where they would freeze their nuclear programs. They'd put in cameras in their reactors. Everything was copacetic. Everything was stable. Everything was solid. No problems. And then Bush comes into office and starts calling people axes of evil. And Bolton starts calling them, you know, by name. Calling Kim Jong-il a little tyrant and things like this may be true. But if you're a diplomat, that's not how you speak about someone. And so what does Kim Jong-il do and what do the Iranians do? Bolton so badly screwed up our relationship with these countries. Yes, you can have a relationship with an enemy country or a country that thinks it's your enemy. Bolton so badly screwed up this relationship that these countries have gone off, you know, off the rails. So an aide to Colin Powell intervenes in this thing. He gets into this situation with a Bolton and Iran. Intervenes, goes around Bolton's back. Bolton doesn't know about it. At Colin Powell's request, and sort of cleans it up a little bit. And this guy, when he's interviewed by Newsweek, well, here, I quote, but the terrified state experts, that's state capital S, the State Department, experts, were, quote, adamant that we not let Bolton know we had talked to them, end quote, the official said. The incident, reports Newsweek, illustrates a key allegation that now bedevils Bolton's nomination to be America's next ambassador to the United Nations. Bolton's critics contend that he has consistently taken an extreme and uncompromising line on issues and that he has bullied subordinates and intel analysts who disagreed with him. Now, as I said, that's the Republican talking points. They're saying, well, you know, he's a tough guy. He doesn't have a nice personality. He kicks butt. And as this Newsweek article by Michael Hirsch says, and I quote, the White House still believes that only a hardliner like Bolton can reform the UN, end quote. Right. I'm sorry, this guy isn't a hardliner. This guy is incompetent. That is the problem. It has nothing to do with the quality of his personality, although that certainly probably has something to do with his incompetence. In fact, I would submit to you that the way that this guy has probably covered up his incompetence his whole life is probably very much the same way George W. Bush has, and that is by intimidating those under him, intimidating those with less power, intimidating those with less wealth, in the case of George W. Bush. And thus, his incompetence doesn't become evident. Nobody talks about it. Everybody's terrified to speak out. Their wife's career will get destroyed. They'll end up, you know, hoping.
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marks out of the White House in handcuffs.
Yeah, see, just hoping, as Joe Wilson says, and he doesn't use names lightly, you know. This guy is a diplomat.
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
Yeah, I do trust him on that. And so what does George W. Bush say about the outing of a CIA agent, the bringing down of a CIA counterterrorism program, the increase in the vulnerability of the United States as a result of Karl Rove or somebody, some senior official, Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney, some senior official in the White House deciding to crash a CIA program to commit treason? What is George W. Bush's response?
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
See, this is Bolton speak. This is how John Bolton views the world. It's no mistake that these guys have nominated John Bolton. It's not an error. He's right up their alley. Right up their alley. As is Tom DeLay. Tom DeLay, another guy who has made his way to the top by being a bully. Now, you could argue that Bill Frist has made his way to the top by being charming and wealthy and buying people off. But Tom DeLay, he's pugnacious, as they say. He's made his way to the top by being a bully. And as has Bolton. So here we have, you know, the dynamic duo, Tom DeLay and John Bolton. Two peas in a pod. And Robert Novak now. Robert Novak, the guy who wrote the article that outed Valerie Plame, whose husband we just heard from and George W. Bush we just heard from commenting about it. Robert Novak, the guy who, if anybody's going to go to jail for this thing, it should be him, right? Instead of Judith Miller and this other guy. Robert Novak writing today in the Sun-Times, the Chicago paper that he writes for, taking a whack at John McCain. taking a whack at John McCain. Sources close to Senator John McCain, writes Robert Novak, say he hopes the Justice Department will indict embattled Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff, which would terminate investigation by McCain's Senate Indian Affairs Committee of Abramoff's deals with Indian tribes. Trying to paint John McCain with the Abramoff brush. Maybe it's a legitimate thing. Maybe John McCain is dirty on this. But the point that it makes is what I've been saying all along. The Republican Party is starting to disintegrate. John McCain, for all his weirdnesses and eccentricities, isn't a go-all-the-way corporatist like Bill Frist. He isn't one who absolutely gives in to corporate interests. He still has some small shred of integrity left. Only a small one. And that's too much for the rest of the Republicans. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's time now for a Borowitz report from Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com. Bush admits, the headline, he no longer understands his own Social Security proposal. During a speech in Flint, Michigan today, President Bush sent shockwaves through the debate about Social Security by admitting that he no longer understands his own proposal for revamping the nation's retirement program. The Flint speech had been billed as a pep rally of sorts for the president's ambitious Social Security overhaul, which made his candid admission that he could not make, quote, not make heads or tails of the darn thing, end quote, all the more surprising. Mr. Bush told his audience, many of whom audibly gasped, quote, I have read it over and over again, and I've got to tell you, I don't have a clue what it means. I had an easier time figuring out the Da Vinci Code. At the White House, spokesman Scott McClellan acknowledged that Mr. Bush's bafflement over his own Social Security proposal may push back implementation of the controversial plan. Scott McClellan said, quote, according to current estimates, it's highly unlikely that the president will actually understand this plan anytime before the year 2029, end quote. To speed up that timetable, Mr. McClellan said that Mr. Bush is ordering a worldwide manhunt to find somebody who can understand his Social Security proposal and explain it to him as soon as possible. Said Mr. McClellan, and if that person turns out to be Osama bin Laden, we'll be killing two birds with one stone. That from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Now, in a more serious tone, here we have a Social Security program that is basically a scam. The Bush administration running around saying, okay, Social Security is at a crisis. It's spending more money than it's bringing in. Now, that is the status, actually, at this moment, of Medicare. As a result of the Republicans putting in this phony drug bill. Well, it's not phony in that it actually delivers drugs, but it's a phony program in the context of, you know, a good government program that serves we the people because it serves the corporate interests. The government is now, by law, not allowed to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for prices for Medicare. Now, the Pentagon can negotiate. They can go in and say, we're going to buy 1 million tablets of penicillin this year. How, you know, what's your best price? The Pentagon can do that. But Medicare can't. Yes, it is bizarre. Yes, it is incredibly bizarre. And so here now we have Harry Reid. And so you have the Medicare program is broken. Social Security still has 30, 40 years to go before it has a problem. But Bush is hysterical about Social Security. Why? Because it's the socialism he doesn't like. In any case, his attempt to privatize it is going nowhere, and Harry Reid came out and said it. Senator Harry Reid, Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, it's dead. The president just hasn't acknowledged it yet. It's dead.
No, it's not. It's just pining for its mate.
Now it's dead.
Well, it's okay.
Yeah, it really is. Social Security. Tote. Over the edge. The end. And a good thing, too. At least the Bush plan.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his Vicodin. Or his, well, who knows what he's on these days. Clearly nicotine. Yes, I have to confess, I was once a nicotine addict myself. 32 years ago, 33 years ago, I guess, something like that. 30-some-odd years ago, anyway. When Louise became pregnant with our eldest, we both quit smoking. She quit immediately and gave me the ultimatum, sleep on the couch or you quit. And it still took me a week or so, but I'll tell you, that was one tough drug to kick, nicotine. You've seen on in the TV news the chimps in, I don't recall where they were. It seems like they were someplace in Asia that have learned how to smoke from people throwing cigarettes into their cages. Makes sense. I mean, this is a very, very potent drug. I recall, I think it was in Andrew Weil's book, From Chocolate to Morphine, he noted that, I believe it was in that book, he noted that nicotine is 5 times more addictive than heroin. And I believe it. I have watched people go through heroin withdrawal, and I've watched people go through nicotine withdrawal, and nicotine withdrawal seems much more difficult, and it takes longer. But anyway, how did I get off on that? I don't know. Any Kerry supporters on the line? The Bush administration punishes some Democrat backers. This is an article in Time magazine by Viveka Novak and John Dickerson. Interesting. They're using the Democrat word now instead of Democratic. You know, for 200 years it was Democratic, the Democratic Party. He's a Democratic senator. And then came Frank Luntz. And Frank Luntz did his polling and his NLP work, and he discovered that when people heard Democratic, they smiled. They got a good feeling. So now it is not the Democratic senator so-and-so, you know, the Democratic senator Pat Leahy. It's now the Democrat senator Pat Leahy. Democrat backers. No, they're Democratic. It's the Democratic Party. Look on the letterhead. The National Democratic Party. This is a way that the Republicans slap the Democratic Party by calling it the Democrat Party rather than Democratic Party. It is not and never has been the Democrat Party. It's the Democratic Party. In any case, so Time magazine, following the herd, first of all, whenever I see that usage, I know that we're dealing with somebody who either has a right-wing bias or has been heavily infected by it. Now, there's this group called the Inter-American Telecommunications Commission, the IATC. And basically what they do is they meet 3 times a year in different cities in North and South and Central America to discuss telecommunications issues. Now, what frequency spectrum should we use for cell phones? What frequency spectrum should we use for satellite phones? How much power should we allow in transponders and repeaters and transmitters and whatnot? And it's mostly engineers getting together and doing engineer speak, although, you know, occasionally it gets political. So Time magazine notes, the State Department has traditionally put together a list of industry representatives for these meetings, and anyone in the U.S. telecom industry who has the requisite expertise and wanted to go is generally given a slot, say past participants. Things have changed now. The Stalinist Bush administration, and I realize that's strong language, but these guys are devoted to single-party rule. I don't know what else to call it. Single-party rule. They're actually quoting Stalin. You got this guy the other day saying, you know, death solves all problems, no man, no problem, speaking of the Supreme Court. In any case, the Stalinist Bushies tracked down an evil guy who worked for Nokia. Or maybe it's Nokia. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. N-O-K-I-A. You know the cell phone company? They make these little cell phones. And Nokia, or Nokia, one of the two largest telecom firms operating in the United States, by the way, was going to send a couple of representatives to this conference. And the Bushies discovered that one of these guys had made a campaign contribution of $250 to John Kerry. He sent Kerry a $250 check, maybe on the Internet. But you see, when you make a contribution to a political candidate, your name gets published. And so the Republican Party checked out the list of people who were going to this IATC meeting, Inter-American Telecommunications Commission, and discovered this poor guy who just happened to exercise what used to be your franchise in this country, your right to support the candidate of your choice, and if he wins or loses, well, that's life. But they found that Nokia had this guy working for them who had sent $250 to the John Kerry campaign in 2004, and so they blew him off the commission. They blew him off the delegation. They said, you can't participate, you can't go. Sorry, tough luck, out of luck, get out of here. In fact, at least four of the two dozen or so U.S. delegates selected for the meeting, sources tell Time, have been bumped by the White House because they supported John Kerry's 2004 campaign. Four out of 20. That's incredible. Two out of 20 is 10%. Four out of 20 is 20%, if I'm doing my math right. I still remember third grade. 20%, roughly, of the people that U.S. industry wanted to send to this meeting. The State Department said, no, you can't go because you gave money to John Kerry. It boggles the mind. Meanwhile, the three people, I think, as I recall, it was two men and a woman. I may be wrong, but in any case, the three people who were dragged out of the, or escorted out, let's say, out of the Bush town hall meeting, paid for with your tax dollars and mine in Denver, because they had a No More Blood for Oil bumper sticker on their car, are trying to figure out who the guy is who directed them out. First, they thought it was the Secret Service. So they went to the Secret Service and they said, okay, who's this guy working for you who's playing political enforcer for George W.? The Secret Service said, we don't do that. We're not political enforcers for him. We protect his life. That's it. You threaten him, you pull out a gun, you make a crank phone call, we'll show up at your door. But otherwise, we keep our nose out of politics. We protect Democratic presidents as well as Republican ones. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. And so the Secret Service says, wasn't one of our guys. But, they said, these three, he was wearing a black suit, he had the thing in his ear, he had the little red pin on his lapel, which identifies you as Secret Service. And he came and he told us that he were strongly implied that he was Secret Service. We're not sure he actually came right out and said it. And he escorted us out, and all the Secret Service guys were standing around watching it happen. And, you know, it was obvious he was one of them. No, he wasn't one of ours, says the Secret Service. He worked for the RNC, the Republican National Committee. So they go to the Republican National Committee and say, oh, so you have official guys in these things. The RNC says, no, no, it was an overzealous volunteer. He was so overzealous, he went out and bought a black suit and a little red pin. Are we getting into the what's wrong with this picture world? Well, now these three Denver progressives who dared have a No Blood for Oil bumper sticker on their car. Apparently they didn't give any money to Kerry, or they would have been filtered out before they even got in the door. Now these three Denver progressives are trying to figure out who it was who escorted them out of this event, who violated their constitutional rights. And the Republican Party is saying, well, we don't know who this volunteer was. He was just a volunteer. And nobody has come forward and said, it was me. Nobody. No Jeff Gannons so far. Nobody who has a website that says that they do CIA, or excuse me, Secret Service impersonations on their off days. So Recht, the lawyer for this group, Dan Recht. Oh, it's two women and a man. The lawyer representing activists Alex Young, Karen Bauer, and Leslie Wise. Recht says he has made Freedom of Information Act requests to nine groups, including the Bush administration and the Secret Service, to try to determine who the man is. So far, he's received no information. White House spokesman, and this is where you get how incredibly arrogant these guys are. White House spokesman Alan Abney said discussing a volunteer would serve no other purpose than to further the three's people's political agenda. It's going to serve no purpose other than furthering their political agenda. What about the purpose of furthering the rule of law? What about the purpose of furthering the Constitution of the United States? What about furthering the purpose of democracy in America? Oh, well, you know, that's not on our agenda. We're Republicans. Yeah. And now, from speaking of partisan politics, from the Democrats comes this. I occasionally will share with you on the air the talking points for the day. We've many times shared with you conservative talking points. Here are the Democratic talking points. In fact, Louise, you know, Candy, it says Candy's available for radio interviews. We ought to get her on the morning show. This is great. Anyhow, President Bush, this Candy Stroud sent this thing out. She's with the Democratic National Committee. And ironically, Louise got it in email, and she's using webmail, and so it had the ads across the top from Google, you know, the Google ads. And here's one that says, pray for Tom DeLay. And it's a serious ad. It says, only prevailing prayer will protect him from his political enemies. Click here. Right? In any case, the headline, Bush has repeatedly failed to stand up to foreign leaders. And then she goes through this litany. Now, I've been, you know, warned you up front, the partisan source for this information. But I've read this, and it's pretty solid, and we're actually quoting mostly right-wing sources. The Weekly Standard, Economic Times, Ebedi Op-Ed, New York Times, NBC, Meet the Press, CNN's Capital Gang, The Washington Post, National Review, New York Times. And right after this break, I'm going to share some of these little clips, some of these little pieces with you, these little stories about how George Bush has wimped out on us. He has completely abandoned the idea of strong America, of a strong America in the world, and abandoned leadership in the international community. You think? You think not? I'll tell you right after this. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's the hard knock.
Yeah.
It's the hard knock.
Stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Uh-huh. It's for all my homies in Bruges.
Remember that. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Amy in San Diego's on the line. Hey, Amy, how are you doing today?
Hey, Tom, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Oh, good. I have a question, and I also have a comment. You were talking earlier about the judges that these extremist judges that are being recycled through. And
they're not even religious extremists, with one exception.
Yes,
they've
right.
got basically one guy who's a Catholic who's come out and said that because he's Catholic, he would have to vote against abortion.
Yes.
And all the rest of them are basically, well, not all the rest of them, most of the rest of them are basically either corporatists or political hacks.
Yes, exactly. Well, you had very short and succinct descriptions of all those judges, and it's very hard to find on the web. Every time I've come to find bios on these guys, they're, you know, like 50 pages long, and I got to find all this stuff. I think it would be great if you could just post that on your website. It would be
well,
a great talking point for us liberals
Amy,
to have on our side.
Here's the bad news.
Uh-huh.
What I had in my hand, I have here a stack of paper that is at least a third of an inch thick that is the bios of these judges.
Yeah.
And I went through this morning with a highlighter, and I was reading selected sentences from them. I found the most succinct bios I could find, though, on SaveOurCourts.org.
Oh, okay, great. I'll go there. And then I have a quick question for you.
Sure.
On Bill Frist's website, his Senate website, he makes the statement that I know is either a lie or completely misleading, and I want you to straighten it out for me. He quoted his website, says, "Never in 214 years, never in the history of United States Senate, has a judicial nominee with majority support been denied an up or down vote until 2 years ago." That can't be true, is it?
I really don't have any idea.
Okay.
One of the problems is that there's no way to know.
Oh, okay.
Because the only way that you determine whether or not somebody has majority support is by having a vote.
Okay.
How else would you know?
Right. I guess that's true. Yeah. Okay. So it's just a totally misleading statement.
It would be useful to get somebody who's a professional at parsing
gobbledygook.
Yeah. Bill Frist speak. You know.
Yes. Exactly.
But whether or not that's the case, I mean, the reality is that up until the Bush administration, the standard operating practice with regard to Supreme Court nominees, and I mean this goes back over 200 years, the standard operating practice was the president would contact the president of the Senate, or this, excuse me, the Senate Majority Leader and the Senate Minority Leader,
right,
and which would be Harry Reid and Bill Frist, or in reverse order, and they would and say, if I send you Priscilla Owens, or if I send you, whoever, if I send you Joe Blow, am I going to have 60 votes, enough to break a filibuster, enough to get this person through?
Right.
And the response, and before 19, as I recall, 1914 or 1917, something like that, it would have been two-thirds vote. It would have been 66 votes. Now it's 60 votes.
Okay.
And so they revised the rules back then to make it actually easier to break a filibuster. But in any case, they would say to the heads of the Senate, if I send this person, will we have enough votes to get them through? And if the answer is no, then they don't send the person.
Right.
Clinton had dozens of people that he wanted to appoint, and he went to the Republicans, and they said, no, you're not going to get your 60 votes. And he said, okay, no problem. And what happened here is that for the first time, never in the 230-year history of America, has a political party played such political hardball.
Exactly, yes. Okay, well, thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome, Amy. Thanks
okay.
a lot for the call.
And bye.
Bye now. And hopefully that puts it in context. That helps frame it a little bit, because that's really what's going on here, is that in the past, the political party, whatever party was, had the presidency, would go to whatever party had the Senate and say, is this going to work or not? And the guys who had the Senate said, no way. It ain't gonna make it. We will filibuster it. And so then the president would say, okay, we'll get somebody else. I mean, if you can't make it through that first filter, then is this really somebody who's qualified to be a judge? Somebody who's qualified to have a lifetime appointment? We're not talking about a law here that can be repealed or undone. We're talking about a lifetime appointment. Anyhow, Bush has repeatedly failed to stand up to foreign leaders. He's got Crown Prince Abdullah in Crawford, Texas today. What does this mean for America? We'll dig into that right after this. Plus your calls, 1-866-889-8894. I'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Walk that walk. Talk that talk, walk that walk, talk that talk, walk that walk.
And welcome back, my friends. That is definitely not the theme song for Bill Frist, I'll tell you. Now, given that George W. Bush has been so effective at coming off like he's just a real bad guy, he's a tough guy, he is, you better be, he's saying to us Americans, y'all better be afraid of them out there, and then he says to us, but I'm a tough guy and I'll take care of them, right? And he says it in a lot of ways. I mean, his speech at the Republican National Convention, for example.
September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists. September the 11th. Danger. Doom. Danger. Doom. Killers. Be afraid. Evil. The world will drift toward tragedy. Tragedy. May God bless you. Evil. God. Iraq. Afghanistan.
And on it goes, of course, you know, for 2 minutes of that cut together. But anyhow, he claims he's quite good at this, you know, at letting us know what's going on and protecting us from it.
On the offensive, evil God, be afraid, God, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back.
Nothing
and
will hold
will
us
prevail.
Back. We will
evil.
Prevail.
And nothing will hold us back.
President Bush will host Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah at his ranch in Crawford, Texas today. In the past, President Bush has failed to stand up to foreign leaders in favor of the American people's interests.
Afghanistan, terror, Pakistan, terrorists.
It's likely that this meeting will be no different. Despite telling then-President Clinton to jawbone OPEC leaders during the 2000 campaign, President Bush has done nothing to alleviate skyrocketing gas prices today. The Republican Party, or the Democratic Party, excuse me, says that they certainly hope that President Bush will listen to the American people and finally stand up to foreign leaders for American interests.
Afghanistan and Iraq, God, fight terrorists, evil God.
The Weekly Standard, here are some quotes. Bush, he says, what I say to foreign leaders publicly, I say privately. This is George Bush at a news conference on April 8th, 05. Okay. Bush has failed to stand up to Crown Prince Abdullah. The Weekly Standard, this is a conservative publication. Bill Kristol's publication. Bush has failed to stand up to Crown Prince Abdullah. Saudi policy toward the United States is based on their perception of our fear of their oil power, which is why Crown Prince Abdullah felt free to patronize President Bush in Crawford, Texas, less than a year after 15 Saudi citizens attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That is why they have felt safe enough to allow more than $50 billion of Saudi oil money to be exported to stir up hatred of the United States in the last 20 years. End of quote from the Weekly Standard. Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate in economics, said Bush must push for freedom in Saudi Arabia. The Bush administration, he wrote in the Economic Times on April 15th of this year, the Bush administration has put expansion of democracy at the center of its foreign policy. This is a far nobler calling than simply questioning the U.S. hegemony. The question is, does Bush really mean it? And does he genuinely understand what democracy means? The Bush administration praised Saudi Arabia's municipal elections, but what about the rights of women, including their voting rights? Well, hey, Joe, you can't have everything. Shirin Ebadi, the 2003 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, criticized Bush's hypocrisy on not pushing for women's rights in Saudi Arabia. So this is all how, you know, Bush says, I'm going to stand up for democracy in the world, and then Prince Bandar or Crown Prince Abdullah show up at the ranch, and Bush is rolling over like a dog wanting its belly scratched. Here, George W. Bush, this from an op-ed in the New York Times by Nobel Peace Prize winner Shirin Ebadi. Quote, given the long-standing willingness of the American government to overlook abuses of human rights, particularly women's rights, by close allies in the Middle East like Saudi Arabia, it is hard not to see the Bush administration's focus on human rights violations in Iran as a cloak for its larger strategic interests. End of quote. William Safire weighs in on this. He says, Bush failed to stand up to Putin. Same thing. I was disheartened and dismayed, said William Safire. By the way, he went eyeball to eyeball with President Putin, and Bush blinked. Here is a president who has been talking eloquently about extending freedom and fighting for democracy around the world in his inaugural address in the State of the Union, and as soon as he comes up against the man who's doing more to stop the extension of freedom than anyone else, he wimps out all of a sudden. I think this is as big a blunder as his father made when he gave the Chicken Kiev speech saying, stay within the Soviet Union. End of quote. Carlson. Margaret Carlson. Okay, you could argue Margaret Carlson is the liberal in the bunch. But about Putin, she said the good thing is that he pressed him at all and that Bush has been very soft on Putin and very reluctant to criticize him despite all of Putin's anti-democratic moves. But Putin is like old Europe. He's just not taking lectures from Bush on anything. I mean, Putin just said, you know, he's not taking anything from Bush on these matters. Well, who else in the world has Bush failed to stand up to? How about Egypt, where they torture people? Well, we're sending people there to be tortured. That's how we know. Bush should call on Mubarak to hold genuine elections, says the Washington Post. An editorial on April 12th of last year. Mr. Bush can tell Mr. Mubarak, not just privately but in public, that he supports those Egyptians who call for lifting the country's emergency law and for reforming the Constitution to allow for genuine democratic elections. Egyptian reformers don't say the change should happen immediately, but they want a firm and detailed timetable. Mr. Bush should ask for one. The National Review. Another conservative publication. Bush failed to push for a reform agenda with Mubarak. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's visit to Crawford today highlights the difficulties and opportunities facing President Bush's commitment to promote democracy in the Middle East. And, you know, on it goes. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There's almost no end to it. He failed to stand up to Hu Jintao, the president of China. He failed to stand up to Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, the dictator of Pakistan. And on and on. So you want a tough guy? Should have gotten John Kerry. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Roy in Rio Rancho is on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. The reason I was calling, I was in the chat room. You probably saw it. My nephew, who spent 12 months in Iraq in the backdoor draft.
Yeah, you've mentioned it on this program a few months ago, I think.
And he got back to Germany a couple months ago. He got sent home, got 30 days worth of liberty, and was, or whatever they call it, leave. Went back to Germany to get mustered out because he was quitting. I mean, this is a guy that was going to make the Army a career. And when he saw how bad things were, how bad they were lying to him and everything else, he just said, that's it. I'm out. I'm not going to do it. He had been approached with reenlistment bonuses as high as $15,000.
Wow.
He refused them. It looks like he's going to be backdoor drafted. They told him they got him by the short hairs until '09.
They've already backdoor drafted him once.
Right. He was supposed to have gotten out last February. And they backdoored him in January. He went to Iraq in late February. 2 days after, actually, he went to Iraq 2 days after he was supposed to have gotten out, which was flight time would have put him home.
Yeah, so this is that I said earlier in the program, this is the most ironic administration in the history of the United States, if nothing else.
He was wounded twice in Iraq. He has had, you know, just jacked around. And, I mean, he's my nephew, so I've got a personal touch to it.
Yeah.
But it ain't the personal, Tom. It's the embarrassment. The country.
Yes.
We're just getting. I'm embarrassed, and it makes me mad. It makes me sad,
yeah.
And it hurts.
Yeah.
It really, really hurts. So anyway, they're out there. They're going to win the war. You know, go down there, and cut brush
with W.
Go down there and you know, take care of that oil. Got to take care of that oil, but it ain't going to take care of the oil. We're going to run out anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but there are a few of W's friends will make a few billion dollars in the meantime. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, that's...
Oh, yeah, and they'll get to talk about how pious he is. If he's that pious, how come his best buddies are those evil Muslims?
And Reverend Moon.
And Moon.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I'm rambling, but I just had to get it out there.
Yeah,
This hits...
It's a tough one, anyway.
I'd forgotten he'd turned down up to $15,000 worth of reenlistment bonuses.
Does he? And he can't take that money now.
No, he don't get it now.
Yeah. So they just say,
he don't get it now.
You turned it
down. And, it's not 100%, but it's like his mother was saying, it's about 75%. He's going back. And this is a guy that's got a 5-year-old son and a 2-year-old son. And
who are being raised without dad.
That's right. Family values, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Family values.
Yeah.
And
well, whenever Bush says anything, it's the old, you know he's lying because his lips are moving. Roy, thanks for the call. I wish you well, and you know, we'll keep your nephew in our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah.
So thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks.
Do
take
good.
Care.
Yep. 1-866-889-8894. Jill in Allendale, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Jill.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just called because I spotted a bumper sticker, and I wanted to pass it on to you. I think it's my favorite.
Okay.
And support Bush's war, draft a Republican.
Ha! I love it.
Okay.
I love it. Okay, thanks, Jill.
Sure, have a good day.
You too. I appreciate the call. Support Bush's war, draft a Republican. I love it. And a real bumper sticker on a real car. Liz in Philly on the line. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Tom. You had a caller asking about straight up or down votes.
Yes.
The quick answer is that the Republicans defeated by filibuster the nomination of Abe Fortas to be Chief Justice in 1968, and on an attempted cloture, Fortas received more yeas than nays, 45-43. So probably on a straight up and down vote, he would have won, but he was defeated by a filibuster of the Republicans.
But 45 is not a majority.
45 is a majority.
It's a plurality.
Well, it's a plurality, but it suggests that there were more people voting for him than against him. On a straight up and down vote with people abstaining, that should have done it.
Yeah, but that's not a majority. It's still not. I mean, Frist is apparently still technically correct because there's 100 members of the Senate. So to have a majority, you'd have to have 51 or 50 plus the
vice president.
But a straight
up or down vote literally means there are more yeas than nays.
Right.
It doesn't mean there's a majority. It means there are more yeas than nays. That's what a straight up or down vote is.
Right. But he's not using that phrase.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought he was.
No.
I thought straight up or down vote is what he was saying.
My recollection is that what he's saying on his website is that never before in the history of the country has a candidate being put forward for judgeship or whatever this position would be called been with the support of the majority of the Senate been denied an opportunity to have a straight up or down vote.
That's what a filibuster is.
I know. I know.
Well, anyway, this, I think, is largely based upon a memorandum that C. Boyden Gray sent around, which is thoroughly debunked at a website, which I will post on the boards.
On the message board at tomhartman.com, you mean?
Yes.
Great.
Okay.
Great. I look forward to checking that out.
Okay.
Liz, thanks so much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Me, what tangled webs they weave, eh? It is getting strange out there. Evidence in Vioxx suits shows intervention by Merck officials. Did you notice this in the New York Times on Saturday, I believe, or Sunday? Today's the 25th, so it must have been yesterday. In 2000, an article by Alex Berenson, in 2000, amid rising concerns that its painkiller Vioxx posed heart risks, Merck overruled one of its own scientists after he suggested that a patient in a clinical trial had probably died of a heart attack. So here you have, within Merck, their own scientists saying, looks like this guy died of a heart attack and he's been taking Vioxx. Maybe we ought to do something about this. In an email exchange about Vioxx, the company's most important new drug at the time, a senior Merck scientist repeatedly urged the researcher to change his views about the death, and now quoting from the email, so that we don't raise concerns, end quote. In later reports of the Food and Drug Administration and in a paper published in 2003, Merck listed the cause of death as unknown for this patient, a 73-year-old woman. 4,600 people are now suing Merck, by the way, and Merck has set aside an enormous pile of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they said they are going to fight every single lawsuit. Nobody's going to get a penny out of them, they say. Maybe 30,000 people died, 50,000 people died, 100,000 people died. There's different numbers in the literature. Certainly more than 3,000 people who died in 9/11. But you can bet nobody is going to say, hey, is it as much of a crime to kill 100,000 of your countrymen for profit as it is to kill 3,000 of the country, you know, of somebody else's countrymen for religion? Which is the greater crime? Clearly, the Bush administration has its priorities set. In their mind, the greater crime is to do it for religion, but only if you're Muslim. You say what? Well, go back and look. Tim McVeigh. Bush did not, last week was the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the federal building bombing in Oklahoma City by Tim McVeigh. Bush did not even attend the ceremony. But if anything happens around 9/11, boy, he is there like lightning on a bug. He is just bang, right there, George W. It's what he does. mixing up 9/11, and himself, I guess. You know, it's 9/11 and the heroic George, the George the superhero, Super George.
Terrorists. September the 11th. Danger.
Yes.
Danger. Doomed killers.
And so, but he's not going to talk about the terrorists within the United States who may pose this kind of threat.
Stand in Iraq, evil darkness, God.
No, he's not going to talk about them. They are white Christians. But he will talk about dark-skinned Muslims. They are a serious threat in his mind. Yeah.
God, be afraid. God, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back.
And nothing will hold us back. When we come back, unpegging the wand. Say what? I'll let you know what that's all about right after this. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son.
And welcome back, my friends. Mr. McKinnon, Mr. Ronald McKinnon of Stanford University is raining on George W.'s parade here in the Wall Street Journal today. Article by Mary Kissel, the outlook is the column. The actual title of the article, Unpegging the Yuan, and that's spelled Y-U-A-N. It's the currency of China. Unpegging the Yuan may not cut trade gap. And they have a list of consumer prices, money wages, labor productivity, all this kind of stuff. As China faces mounting pressure to loosen or replace its exchange... Well, rather than reading, let me just tell you what's going on here. China has been, for some time now, I think for, you know, basically since World War II, let's see, and this is, yeah, well, it doesn't say in the article when it started, but anyhow, for 30, 40 years, for quite some time, the Chinese have pegged their currency to the U.S. dollar. So the U.S. dollar goes up or down, the Chinese currency goes up and down. And what this does is it allows China's trade with the United States to always be very predictable. That's the upside. It also allows China to know that their purchase of oil will always be predictable because oil is denominated in dollars worldwide and gold is denominated in dollars worldwide. It's been the global currency, the dollar. And so China has always linked it to the dollar. And now the Bush administration comes along and says, you know, all these cheap products coming into the United States are wiping out domestic American industries. But rather than putting up a tariff, which might actually raise government revenues and protect specific industries, we would rather China increase the value of its currency relative to the dollar. This would make everything that comes into the United States more expensive, which, by the way, would make the Chinese richer. This is what the Bush administration wants to do. Increase prices here in the United States for Chinese goods, things imported into the United States. So everything at Walmart is going to go up in price. This is their plan. This is how to do it. Isn't this a great idea? And a lot of people have been saying for a long time, yeah, that's the thing to do. Yeah, yeah, right, you know, unpeg the yuan. So now comes Stanford University's Ronald McKinnon, and he's actually done the math on this. He says, if China lets go of its fixed exchange rate of 8.28 yuan to the dollar, quote, that won't reduce its trade surplus with the U.S. and other countries. It's an illusion that it would. An illusion. In fact, HSBC chief economist Stephen King, in a report published in January, estimates that, quote, even a major yuan revaluation, 25% against the dollar, would make scarcely any difference in the U.S. economy. I have been saying this for 2 years, and now the Wall Street Journal has finally figured this out. It's not the yuan. It's whether or not you have a rational trade policy. This administration has no trade policy other than to surrender the sovereignty of this nation to multinational corporations. Multinational corporation comes along, we roll over. whether it's locally with small communities and even large communities, towns, Chicago and Seattle, competing for Boeing and saying, oh, we'll give you more tax breaks, we'll give you more tax breaks, whether it's nationally. Oh, Halliburton, they want to take our government money to fix Iraq, but they want to reincorporate KBR and the Cayman so they don't have to pay taxes. No problem. Or whether it's internationally with regard to China. No problem. If it's a multinational corporation, that's the Bush family. No problem. We need a rational trade policy in the United States. And unfortunately, it's going to take a complete change in administration to make that happen. And that means we have to get active in politics before 2006. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.